Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com coming to you on the 18th of February 2012 here in Japan. It's still the 17th of February 2012 back in the US, where I'm joined on the line once again by Catherine Austin Fitz, formerly a managing director of Dillon Reed & Co. and the former assistant secretary of housing under the Bush Senior Administration. She now spends her time as president of Solari Inc., advising people about what she learned in the belly of the beast and how they can best confront that beast. And of course, she's the publisher of the Solari Report at Solari.com and also an investment advisor for Solari Investment Advisory Services. So once again, Catherine, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you, James. It's always a pleasure.
Well, Catherine, you've written about a process that you've called rethinking diversification or real diversification, which we've often heard of the idea of investment advisors talking about diversifying a portfolio. But you think of a different type of diversification that you put in contrast to that. So why don't you tell us more about this concept and how it differs from the traditional investment strategies?
Sure. There are two things I always look at. I divide the return on an investment between return to the investors and then return to the network. And the total is the total economic return. So I'm very interested, just as we wander around in an environmental ecosystem, an investment wanders around in a financial ecosystem. So I'm very interested in understanding the sort of deeper connections and relationship between a company or an operation or an enterprise or an investment, if you will, and what's going on in the world. So I like to see the connections. And the way that this blog post, Beyond Diversification, began was when I first became an investment advisor. You know, I was an investment banker. And then I started to talk publicly about the corruption, and people came to me and said, would you help me with my investments? And I said, well, I'm not an investment advisor. And after about the 100th time I said that, I said, well, I guess I'm going to become an investment advisor. But one of the first things I found was people would bring me portfolios that had many different stocks and bonds and many different mutual funds, and they would tell me that the reason they had all of these stocks and bonds and mutual funds is that their advisor wanted them to be diversified. And what I realized looking at it was if you looked at all the bonds and stocks or all the bonds and stocks in the mutual funds, all of the companies that they were investing in were highly dependent on U.S. government contracts and purchases, or the bonds were highly dependent on debt service by the Treasury. And what I realized was there was no diversification. It was one, you know, they were basically, their entire portfolio was completely dependent on the U.S. Treasury to be able to roll over its debt. And what I realized is whatever this is, it's not diversified. So we started to think about how for our clients could we achieve real diversification. And one of the things I quickly realized is I like to have diversification according to different kinds of industries and purpose, but I like to have diversification according to place. And place is not just where you bank or where you invest, but who is the custodian and where are the securities or assets resident. That was something 5 years ago, James, most people weren't interested in. Today, after MF Global, we've all gotten very interested in it. So I think of diversification is what are my assets? Where do their real value come from? Is it from government or is it from force or is it from real economic activity? And then where are they? And I'm a bit of a squirrel. I like to have, you know, a little bit here and a little bit here, and I never like to have everything in one place. You know, I was always amazed when I saw people who had, for example, 100% of their assets in Madoff. So, you know, so having things sort of spread around in different kinds of asset categories and in different places to me is valuable.
Absolutely. And you raise such a fundamental point that it almost beggars belief that other investment advisors wouldn't have thought of this before. Clearly, this process of centralized diversification that they're arguing for is something that has been sort of engineered into the system. Can you speak to the ways in which or the reasons for which this has become sort of the standard way of diversifying a portfolio?
Well, I think, you know, in fairness, there are some pretty logical reasons why somebody would want to centralize it. I will tell you that my clients have much more complicated tracking and statement archiving than somebody who has it all in one place. So if you have it in one place, it's much more simple to follow and track. You know, and if you're one advisor, it's very hard as an advisor to say, no, I don't want all your money. Take your money and go someplace else. Because obviously your business depends on the more money you manage, the better off you are. So I think there's some logical reasons that relate to cost and efficiency why people have tended to centralize. But for many, many years, we've been in a financial bubble where the economy is growing and investors are generally doing reasonably well. And so there's no reason to be concerned about this. Now that we're in a very different environment, and you really have to be concerned about corruption in a whole world of institutions you never had to worry about before, suddenly these issues are coming to the fore. And I will say this, if you read Beyond Diversification, or Rethinking Diversification, what you'll see is I'm really talking about a system that I learned as a child. This is the philosophy that very old wealthy families have been following for centuries. Because if you look at the idea of protecting intergenerational wealth through many generations, the critical issue is, you know, I have to plan to survive through collapses and through wars and through these very traumatic circumstances. And these philosophies and principles have evolved over the centuries, and that's what they do. And that's basically the system I was taught as a very young person. So in a sense, it's not anything new. It's just we didn't need it during the bubble, and now it's time to bring it back out of the closet and say, you know, this has worked for centuries. Let's remember, you know, what the plan was.
Well, as you've pointed out in some of your other writings, both the bubble and the bursting of that bubble have been carefully engineered and is part of a long-term strategy. Can you speak to that strategy and what's really at play behind the times that we find ourselves living in that require this decentralized diversification?
Well, we've been going through a process, and this is what I talked about in Financial Coup d'Etat. We've been going through a process where we've been centralizing the economy, and part of our, you know, we live on a planet where it's still a mystery how the planet is governed and who's really governing it and why they're governing it the way they do. I wrote an article, an interview for the Daily Bell at the beginning of the year where I said, you know, the most important question is who's really running the show and why are they behaving this way? And the $64,000, you know, the answer to the $64,000 question is we don't know. But I can only guess. Let's look at some of my guesses. We have technology changing things in a way that fundamentally shifts how investment can behave. So in the 90s, we saw the rollout of very serious global satellite systems. And between the United States' control of the sea lanes and the control of the satellite systems, it made it possible for investment to shift in ways that it never could before, because money never goes where enforcement can't follow. So the technology has been, and the digital technology and telecommunications allowed us to outsource functions globally in a way that we couldn't logistically do it before. So they're very, very compelling economics to shifting things into the emerging markets. And that's what we saw. And what happened is literally in the first world, we have in Europe and the United States, we have a whole generation of baby boomers who've been saving, saving, saving. That money's been piling up in pension funds. It's been piling up in governments. It's been piling up in a variety of ways. Grossly oversimplified, what happened was we pumped the economy with a debt bubble, took huge amounts of capital out of Europe and North America and the first world, and shifted it into the emerging markets, reinvesting it in a way that fundamentally shifted the value of labor versus capital. And part of this was created or made possible legally by the creation of the Uruguay round of GATT and the creation of the World Trade Organization. So we fundamentally shifted the model from one that was centric to North America and Europe and rebalanced it globally. As that happened, though, who owned those assets changed a lot, number one. Number two, one of the things that happened with that, James, that's very important to understand, is a fundamental reengineering of the relationship between the private sector and government. So what we watched is what I call a financial coup d'etat, where assets are moved out of individual households and out of governments and into private investor hands at below market prices. So think of it as a theft. I call it piratization. and liabilities were shifted back into government. And we're literally transitioning to a world where governance of the control ownership of assets is going to be in the hand of private corporations and investors, not governments and households. So,
well, that's exactly right. And that's why I think that that decentralization that we were talking about in the Rethinking Diversification article is so important, because it seems that this process has been predicated on that centralization of power at first the national and the international level through international agreements. And without that sort of reservoir, that trough being there in that centralized power, I think this system wouldn't be able to function properly.
Well, part of the reason you want to decentralize is you never want to be a target. So, for example, if I have everything in Madoff and or I have everything in the futures account at MF Global and they decide in the great game of economic warfare to take out that party, if I've got everything there, I can lose everything. So you want to be, decentralized if only that you don't want to have everything in one place where, you're a target, unless, of course, you have a private army to watch it. So part of it is that, but I think part of the reason we want to decentralize is the fundamental problem is not that we're centralizing the economy. The fundamental problem is, as we centralize the economy, we dramatically reduce wealth. And if you look at the different ways we could go through this transition of applying new technology to the economy and living in a world where we're over 7 billion people globally, I would argue that rather than centralize into tight control, better instead to reorganize the financial system so within places, so within small units of geography, people have incentive to align their economic activity with the health of living things. Okay, So 7 billion people are putting too much stress on the planet's environment as it's currently being managed. But what I'm saying is, let's organize. If you organize a financial system the way we do, so that everybody makes money in the stock market from an industry going up, as opposed to a place being more beautiful and healthy, then you're going to have corporations making money by destroying places. You're going to have private investors making money by going into Greece and ransacking the place, which is what is happening. If instead we finance places with equity, then we make money from places succeeding, including succeeding environmentally. And so we rebalance the relationship between living things and financial capital into one that's win-win instead of win-lose. Because the problem with the centralization is not that a few people control everything. A problem is it's shrinking total wealth. And when I say total wealth, I don't just mean financial wealth. We're shrinking and destroying environmental wealth. So the fundamental model doesn't make sense. And I can appreciate why somebody running it just says, hey, let me take control. Let me mention one other thing with the current model. Right now, if you break down how we are financing places, what you will see, and this won't surprise you because the Corbett Report has covered this a lot, is literally the entire planet is getting financially harvested. We have invisible taxation through the currency system, through the corruption, through the fraud. And James, that taxation is more than you could. I mean, when I try and explain to people how big it is, it's just unfathomable to most people that they could be taking that much. And it's funny because that's how wealthy the planet is. It's amazing. If you see how much they're stealing, you start to appreciate how much wealth there really is. There's no economic reason for poverty. It's incredible. But I think the time has come where we globally have to ask the question, who's doing this and where is all this money going? Because we've literally reached the point where a group of soccer moms anywhere from Latin America to Asia to where I live in Tennessee, cannot stop hard narcotics trafficking because a very centralized group of people are depending on the cash flows from the drug business to finance their spaceships or whatever. So, we've reached a breaking point where we can't afford this kind of harvesting, and not just financially, we can't afford it spiritually, politically, everything else. And so we're going to go hopefully into a process where we come clean, where we say, okay, what's really going on and what are we going to do about it?
Well, as you've said, it is time for us globally to start asking that question: who's doing this, right, and where's the money going? But as you've said, we don't know those answers yet. Do you think there's a time that we will be able to discover this? Do you think people will be held accountable for what's going on, or has the system become so unaccountable that it's completely out of control?
Well, I call it the breakaway civilization. I literally think what we are watching. And that's, you know, part of my job as an investment advisor is to protect people from the breakaway civilization. We have a breakaway civilization whose technology has become so advanced and whose command of financial resources has become so concentrated that they've just stopped communicating or relating with us. You know, you had that wonderful quote. I don't remember the exact words that one of the Bushies said, and the book by Ron Susskind, I think, said, where he said, you know, look, you know, we make history. We're just going to go off and do what we do. And you can observe and object and write about it, but we're just going to do it. And that's what I saw when I worked in the Bush administration. You know, the attitude was, I'll give you a perfect example. We had a big meeting with the Secretary of HUD. And I was making a proposal to deal with a program that was really troubled called coinsurance. And the general counsel kept recommending that we do something that was illegal. And I kept objecting to it on the grounds that it was illegal. And I won't use the F word on the show, but the general counsel, who had come from the Department of Justice and later became the governor of Oklahoma, said, you know, F them, you know, by the time they win in court, we'll be gone. What do we care? And so there was this attitude of we're above the law. And I literally once said, I had a regional administrator once say to the secretary, was very angry at him and yelling at him about a decision he'd made. And the regional administrator said, but Mr. Secretary, I had no choice. It's the law. And the secretary said to him, the law, the law. I don't have to obey the law. I report to a higher moral authority. You know, and you sort of had this vision of the of that group of people and eyes wide shut, you know, looking through the veil. And you know, but you had this attitude of, you know, we're just going to ransack the place and take whatever we want and do whatever we want. And, you know, it's very frightening. And so you have this breakaway civilization, and they are functioning above the law with impunity. And the reality is that any financial system depends on trust. And when you have a group of people operating with advanced weaponry and the ability to kill with impunity with no accountability, then the trust breaks down. And that's exactly what we're watching. And it's not a financial problem. It's a problem of lawfulness. It's a, you know, you can't be a civilization without being a civilization. And if you're going to not be a civilization, then you can't have a civilized financial system. I mean, these are very simple, you know, kindergartners get these concepts. And so we don't have a financial problem. We don't have an economic problem. We have a political problem. Who is the breakaway civilization? Why are they behaving this way? And why are the rest of us spending thousands of hours, you know, the average American household spends more time than you can possibly imagine, you know, consuming lies and getting hiccup by the fact that their map of the world is just rife with lies. So we've reached a breaking point, I think, spiritually, culturally, and that's why the conversation is now going to get very interesting, because I see people throughout my business and life who are ready to sit back and say, okay, I'm willing to tolerate the inconvenience. Who's really doing this?
Well, that's right. And you point out that Karl Rove quote where he was talking, we are history's actors and you can write about us and you'll observe us, but we can change the reality on the ground. But I think what's interesting about that quote is what it points to is the fact that part of what gives this breakaway civilization, these people who think that they are the, you know, have this whatever higher moral authority to do whatever they want or whatever they think, part of their power comes from the fact that people are observing them and they are following them and they are thinking about them. But to me, that speaks again to the process of decentralization and getting away from the system that they're creating. And the idea that you talked about of creating an alternative financial or economic system that's based more at a local level and is more about building up wealth in the local environment and in the local community, which to me suggests that this breakaway civilization can only function because we are giving it our wealth. We are giving it our money, our time, and our attention.
Right. And, you know, the funny thing is, in defense of, and I didn't realize it was Karl Rove who said it, but in defense of Karl Rove, he has a picture of where he wants to go. And he's acting to get there. And, in fact, as you said, that's exactly what the rest of us need to do. We need to create a picture of where we want to go and say, Karl, you know, you just need to go there without us because we're going to go over here. And if you look at, if you sit down and you look at a household or you look at a municipality, what you will see, whether it's our bank deposits, whether it's our purchases, whether it's our transactions, whether it's our investments, we're financing Karl building the picture he wants, you know, as opposed to building the picture we want. So part of this is reengineering our time, you know, whether it's our media time or who we pay attention to, our money, blah, 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 go down the list. And saying, look, we're going to use all of our time and all of our money to build the picture we want. And yes, I think the picture needs to be two things. One is it needs to decentralize economic and political power to the extent it makes sense. Because globalization wants to happen. You know, I want to talk to somebody in Singapore and I want to know my friend in Hong Kong and, you know, I want to be here and there. So globalization wants to happen, but it's not globalization through Wall Street or through Washington or through a big corporation. It's globalization network to network, person to person. So it's decentralized. So it needs to decentralize, but it needs to be wealth building because, you know, there's no, I mean, our economy is shrinking in terms of wealth, and it needs to be wealth building in a way that aligns living things with money. Okay, because in some respects, money is just a reflection of our accumulated and stored time and, you know, our value of different assets around us. So money is just people's expression of their time and their health and their needs, you know, through time and space. So in a sense, it's all living, but we need to realign those things. And the way to start to do it is in your own day-to-day life, because for the world to be more coherent, whether it's financially or other ways, I need to be more coherent. Okay. So the first thing is to clean up my money. I have an article called Coming Clean, and it's really about going through your life and saying, you know, let's get the Karl Roves of this world out of our life and out of our money. And so, you know, I've written a lot about how to switch to a good local community bank or credit union. You know, that's a perfect first step. So step one is how do I do that? But then step two is how do I turn to my family, to my friends, to my network, and to people in the place that I live? And then how do I start to do it with them? And one of the things I talk about in rethinking diversification is when you start to look at, okay, how do I get real diversification? One of the things you ask yourself, the first thing is, who do I trust? Okay. And, you know, if I'm going to put money, one of the things I encourage people to do is look at, you know, where do you have people you trust in other countries? And then what are the assets around them that you would be interested in owning? So a lot of times you'll see people buy a real estate property next to a cousin who lives in the Philippines, for example, or you've got a kid who lives in Costa Rica. And, you know, so you start to work through your networks and see where are the people I trust. And what are the things I could be doing with the people I trust? Another thing I do and I recommend to people, I have a little investment club called a Salary Circle. And we meet once a week by telephone just to help each other think through what in the world's going on in the environment. And the way it's evolved, we have people from all over the country. And it's wonderful because you get a perspective on what's going on in Chicago, what's going on in Oregon, what's going on in North Carolina, what's going on in Massachusetts. And you get a real feel, at least here, we're all domestic for the US market. And you're not alone. You're not alone in going through this transition together.
Well, then let's transition to a somewhat more speculative note, because when we start to transition to that society, of course, we know what the society that we've been engineered into looks like after the financial coup d'etat, as income disparity starts to become even greater, and as you mentioned, the environment tends to be utterly destroyed in the name of profit, and all of these terrible things are happening around us, and we all understand that's wrong. So thinking about a society where we start to transition into that more local, decentralized, wealth-building mindset, what would that society actually look like? How would it differ from what we're experiencing today?
Well, it's a great question, and I think it would look different in different places. I don't think there's a model, you know, it's funny, I was just at a wonderful conference in Switzerland, and we had a whole group of wonderful eco-villages represented, and I kept telling them to be careful. I kept saying, you know, one man's eco village is another man's labor camp, so be careful. So I don't think there's one model, and a lot of what the model would look like would depend on the cultural rules and laws that that place wanted to have and create. So there are people who want to exist without money and do everything, you know, totally as a commune. I tell them good luck, have at it. I'm not, you know, I don't think that's going to work as well, but what it would look like, first of all, is you would have, you would probably have a lot more of the essential services done in that place. So for example, in North America, the food gets shipped from far, far away. And if you look at the economics of doing more in that place, you would do more in that place. So I think one is there would be a higher degree of self-sufficiency, particularly as to food and, you know, sort of the staples of life. That's number one. Number two, I think you'd have many more skills within that place. You'd have a richer people at younger ages. If you go back and look at the educational system in the 1800s, young people learned how to do many more things, particularly concrete things. So the economics would be, particularly with the new kind of software technology, is, you know, whereas someone and I, like I went to school and never learned how to do the electricity and plumbing on my house, it's very economic for everybody to learn more of those concrete skills. So I think that would be second. The third is I think there would be a lot more transacting and investment locally. So there's no reason not to have a stock market for your county or a venture fund for your county or a mutual fund for your county. So you would see those things go on. You'd see a lot more in barter, not just barter of something denominated in currency, but barter of time. So I just came from the Rogue Valley in Oregon. They have started a time bank and a trade exchange. And there are many differences of these things. The third thing is I think you would see much more cooperative financing of alternative energy. So more of this and that, renewable energy projects, whether it's solar or geothermal, and you'd see the spread of that with more of the work being done locally. And then I think you'd see trading, instead of a lot of the economic flow going through Wall Street or Washington, you'd see much more robust trading place to place. So, you know, I'd be doing deals for my county with a solar energy company. But then I would start trading with a municipality in China, you know, it could be very robust. So I think you would see much more circulation within a place and then much more circulation of economic activity between places without going through the financial centers. I mean, right now in most counties, America breaks down into 3,100 counties, James, in most counties, you have tremendous suck, you know, this huge sucking sound of economic activity up into Wall Street and Washington, and then everything is frozen down on the ground. And one of the reasons it's frozen is the entire place has steadily become, it's gone from having zero dependency on federal government credit and appropriations to being 50% or more dependent. So people are on Social Security, they're on food stamps. They're highly, highly financially dependent. And of course, that kills innovation. And the innovation which is most expensive, the innovation that's most expensive is you're not applying new technology to the day-to-day things in life that get us productivity within a place. So you see huge time waste, and you see huge waste of productivity in functions that, if you look at what the technology could do, it's, you know, it doesn't have to be that way. So you're watching a society literally die economically and be managed sort of on life support by government checks. And so the innovation is going out, the vitality is going out, and the question is, how do we reverse that?
Well, that is the not $64,000, $64 trillion question, maybe, but right. Absolutely. And the world that you describe, I think, makes much more sense to a lot of people and sounds a lot better than the financial coup d'etat that we've lived through, or the breakaway civilization all of the plundering and looting that they're doing of even the first world now, as they've been doing in the third world for a long time, as you know. But ultimately, optimistic or pessimistic that we will be able to transition to such a society before the breakaway civilization completes its destruction of the rest of us?
I'm an optimist. And part of the reason I'm an optimist is, if you spend as much time looking at the numbers and the mathematics and the money, what you realize is there's no economic problem. The wealth is so... You know, one of the reasons to take the time to understand the extent of the harvesting is to understand how wealthy this place is. There's incredible resources. There's incredible wealth. And so, you know, if I'm behaving badly and things are going down, you know, people are always saying, you know, there's no hope, there's no way out. I'm like, wait a minute. You know, if you look at how we're all behaving in dysfunctional way, you know, if everybody behaves dysfunctionally, of course there are no solutions. But if everybody behaved functionally, you know, there are many, many solutions. So I'm an optimist. I think the question is, how much pain do we need to experience before enough people are willing to take responsibility and say, enough, you know, we have to change. So I don't underestimate the power of the breakaway civilization, but my personal philosophy is, if you look at the power, you know, if you study physics and you practice any spiritual practice, what you know is the greatest power on this planet does not come out of the barrel of a gun. It comes from what the Chinese would call the mandate of heaven. And the Chinese, you know, the old Chinese philosophy, and I'm laughing because you're out in the Orient, the old Chinese philosophy is that force is not enough to authenticate a ruler. You know, the ruler must have the mandate of heaven. The ruler must do a good job at governing. And the breakaway civilization, as far as I'm concerned, does not have what one of my allies would call the juice necessary to govern a big planet. I don't care how many people they can kill. They don't have the juice. And, you know, I think if they keep going the way they're going, we don't need to worry that they're just going to kill us. You know, they're probably going to kill each other. So I don't think they have the juice to go the distance. And the question is, how do we, and I think you said it right, let's not worry about them. How do we build a picture and start emerging the world that we want to have in place when they fail? So I don't think they have a plan that will go the distance, but it is not an inconsequential job for 7 billion people to get together, build a covenant, and change a 500-year-old model, let alone put up with a breakaway civilization. That's a big job. And I think it's going to take a long, serious conversation, and the decider of what happens is going to be whether it's our prayers or our thoughts or our transactions. What does each one of us choose to do in our life? Because this is a one, you know, we may not get a vote in the polling booth without Karl Rove's computing machines, but we all get a vote in the field. And so our vote in the field is expressed by how we run our lives, our time, our money, and ultimately it's going to scale up from that. So that's where, you know, there are plenty of solutions. And I know it's frustrating to understand that my solution depends on all of you in Japan also changing. And I don't control any of you. All I do is control myself, maybe on a good day. So that's frustrating to have to collaborate with that many people. the reality, and I'll speak for North America, we've had a covenant that respected individual rights for many, many years. But that covenant was financed by destroying the rights of the people who were here before most of us got here, and destroying the rights of people all around the world while we stole their resources cheap and made them take funny paper. So the reality is, you know, we are going to have to say, wait a minute, that's not going to work. We need to reinvent the covenant of respecting individual rights to include every person on the planet. And our economic models have got to start with that non-violation of each and every person. Because that, you know, that is step one to respecting life. You move out to respecting the animals and the environment from there. But that's where we're going to have to start. And if we want a financial system that works, it's going to have to start with that kind of lawful covenant and the trust that comes with that kind of lawful covenant if we choose to enforce it.
Catherine Austin Fitz, Solari.com, always a fascinating conversation. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, James.